sort of in words, what the similarities and differences between higher dimensional black holes and lower the Kerr black holes that we are used to are. In particular, one of the interesting things is that many of these black holes are unstable to the Gregory Laplace instability. I'll describe what various conjectures were on the end state of this instability, and then I'll show you some the numerical work that me and Luis did last year that I think gives relatively strong evidence to what this end state really is. Okay, so why study higher dimensions, in particular higher dimensional gravity? Well, I think we know that there's something wrong with general relativity, or at least the conservative point of view is that because it predicts singularities generically, there's something wrong with it as a fundamental theory of nature, of space and time. Similarly, quantum mechanics in some of those regimes are at least in the back of the envelope inconsistent with general relativity. So if you believe quantum mechanics, you believe general relativity, the regimes were inconsistent. And perhaps the way in which people usually go about thinking about resolving this is that there must be some theory of quantum gravity. There are several candidate theories of quantum gravity. One of the perhaps more promising ones is string theory. And string theory generically predicts that there are more space-time dimensions than four. Incidentally, even you might think, well, there might not be astrophysical consequences. But if there really are extra dimensions, it would be very bizarre if nature didn't in some way make it observable. On the other hand, even if string theory isn't correct, over the last few years there's been sort of a remarkable set of developments associated with this ADS-CFT correspondence of string theory. That's sort of a conjecture that relates physics described by conformal field theory on the boundary of anti de Sitter spacetime with full string theory in the bulk spacetime. In particular, in the strong coupling limit of the conformal field theory, the correspondence is between the weak field limit or the weak limit of string theory, which is pure Einstein gravity. And what is sort of one way in which the researchers have been sort of extending or using that correspondence is they've been able to describe or at least come up with toy models of a lot of interesting physics, superconductors, superfluidity, strongly coupled quark and gluon plasmas. And using this ADS-CFT, they've been able to describe some of these physical processes using gravity in anti de Sitter space. And I think what's quite interesting is that so far, pretty much all of these dual processes in the bulk space-time have something to do with black holes. It's black hole physics which is dual to all of these other processes. And so I think that there's, there are two ways in which you can look at it. One way is that there's something really, really deep going on here. Why on earth do black holes know so much about fundamental physics? Various branches of fundamental physics that they should have no rights to know about, at least at a first glance. And that might suggest, well, there's something really interesting that this correspondence is pointing to. On the other hand, perhaps just the more sort of trivial, but still, I think, interesting suggestion here is, well, the black holes in higher dimensions, the dynamics governing them is so rich that you can map a whole range of physics to black hole physics. So I think there's a lot of interesting reasons to study higher dimensional black holes.
Yeah. Black hole with a black ring around it. Yeah. Okay, so how
are high dimensional black holes different from four dimensional black holes? And for the most part, essentially, you can just apply your intuition about four-dimensional black holes. They're exactly what you think of them, either in terms of global definitions. So if you have a well-defined asymptotic structure, you can define them in terms of event horizons, the boundary of the causal past of some future infinity. They also are more, you can define them in terms of the more intuitive local definition, that they are trapped surfaces, so regions undergoing gravitational collapse. And though there haven't been very many studies of sort of full dynamics in higher dimensions, there have been a few that also links these higher dimensional black holes to what you would you think of sort of in a more usual setting as being the end state of gravitational collapse. They contain geometric singularities. They're governed by the usual laws of black hole mechanics. And if you look at sort of semi-classical processes, they Hawking radiate. So in that process, it's just like four-dimensional black holes. However, at least in two interesting regimes, well, two interesting properties of them are actually drastically different. The first is that there's no uniqueness of stationary solutions in the same sense that there's uniqueness of the Kerr solution. In other words, if you have an isolated Kerr black hole, you can completely describe the space-time geometry exterior to the event horizon by just specifying two numbers, the mass and the angular momentum. But that's not significantly different in higher dimensions, except that if you specify some of these asymptotic charges, there are sometimes multiple solutions that correspond to that. For instance, a sphere or a black ring or something like that might have exactly the same charges. So you lose that uniqueness that you have in four dimensions. And the other interesting thing, which is going to be the topic of this talk, is that many of these black holes, unlike their four-dimensional counterpart, are unstable to perturbations. So we're going to be looking at black strings, in particular the five-dimensional black string, which is perhaps one of the simplest solutions. And here we just written down the metric for it, and it's just the Schwarzschild solution, so the four-dimensional Schwarzschild solution here written in Schwarzschild coordinates, and now we just add an extra Euclidean dimension. And this is a solution to the five-dimensional vacuum Einstein equations, a one-parameter family of solutions, and now you just interpret this parameter as a mass per unit length as opposed to the total mass of the spacetime. So a very simple solution, and I think it came as quite a surprise to people when back in 93, Gregory and Laflamme showed that these were actually unstable to long wavelength perturbations. And so it's sort of very schematic. They said, well, let's take that background metric and perturb it by a certain amount and look for various modes. And for modes within the four-dimensional subspace decay, in some sense, as you would expect from the four-dimensional case. But there are modes in this extra dimension, this W, that actually have a positive real coefficient dependent on time. So this mu here is a wave number. So this is just the spatial dimension. So this would be the five-dimensional case, but you can see they looked at a whole bunch of dimensions. And so large U is the short wavelength, the high-frequency perturbation. So there are no positive modes. But as you look at some point, at some critical wave number corresponding to a critical wavelength, in this case for the five-dimensional case of about 14.3 M, you get a set of unstable modes, or modes that grow exponentially in time. So, of course, that's at the linear level, and so you want to know, well, okay, where are these, what is the end state of this instability? Where are these black strings going to evolve to? And they sort of had a couple of arguments, and, well, the first one just sort of, what is this wavelength, what is this sort of perturbation do to the horizon? Well, that seems to make it want to become, sort of clump up into these spheres. But perhaps the stronger argument was sort of based on the area or the entropy, so using this thermodynamic relationship between area and entropy of black holes. And they notice, well, let's suppose this does develop to a situation where it completely pinches off at the local minima, and you form a series of five-dimensional hyperspherical black holes. And let's suppose they're separated by some length, LC, and let's compare the area per unit length of these set of five-dimensional black holes with a corresponding black string of exactly the same mass per unit length. And if you do that, this is what you get. And it turns out that above some critical length, the black holes, the sequence of black holes, has more area than the sequence than the black string. And so if you relate entropy to area, that suggests that entropically, the way that the system wants to evolve is it wants to go to a sequence of black holes. But this is a purely classical situation, and in particular, the no bifurcation theorems of classical general relativity still apply. In other words, black holes don't bifurcate unless there's a violation of cosmic censorship, some form of naked singularity. So if that happens, this would be a generic example of cosmic censorship violation in higher dimensions, at least, in a sense that you don't have to fine-tune any initial conditions or come up with a bizarre situation. It's a generic long wavelength instability of these objects that leads to naked singularities. So that, I think, that was sort of the general expectation until perhaps about a decade later, when Gary Horowitz and Maeda proved that using the Rache-Hadoury equation, that if you take a cross section of the horizon, it can't pinch off or it can't shrink down to zero size and finite affine time of the generators of the horizon. So they said, well, okay, one possibility is, well, it could pinch off in infinite time, but if sort of infinite affine time was associated with infinite asymptotic time, that isn't really in any sense sort of, it's morally not a violation of cosmic censorship because you'll never see it. But in any case, they sort of argued that that was an unnatural behavior. And instead, then they conjectured, well, it's not going to go to the sequence of black spheres. Rather, it's going to evolve to some translationally, it's going to lose its translational symmetry. It's going to form some wiggly string-like solution. And this spurred many people to look for such solutions, and many, many wiggly string solutions were found. However, all of them had less area, in other words, less entropy, than the black string that you started from, and so they could not be the end state of the Gregory Lefort instability. So several of us then shortly afterwards tried to do a numerical simulation, so to try to take a black string, perturb it in some sense, and actually just evolve the space-time and see what happens. Unfortunately, the simulation didn't go for very long before it crashed, so what's plotted here is a sequence of snapshots of the apparent horizon. And so starting with a black string, you see the perturbation develop, and then it goes to a state which sort of looks like sort of spherical-like regions connected by these thin strings. But at this point, things were still fairly dynamical and the code crashed, and so we couldn't really conclude what the end state was. I mean, to us, it seemed like it might look... Sorry, yes. Yes, yeah, so that's a linear, so does the area increase at the linear level? Oh, right. Order of magnitude, well, at least I showed you the two cases with just sequences of spheres and black strings. Order of magnitude, that's about the same. So, yeah. Okay, so at least, well, to me, that seems sort of more consistent with the pinch-off conjecture, but of course, because it was still dynamical, we really couldn't conclude what might happen. But perhaps one interesting thing that sort of in the subsequent study, and Don Maroff also noticed it, is if you just look at the natural way in which an affine parameter along the horizon grows as a function of a well-defined asymptotic times, the affine time with an asymptotic time grows on a generator of just a static black string solution, the relationship is exponential. In other words, the affine time grows exponentially. And so if this is what's happening at this sort of these thinning neck regions, the corresponding sort of scale to make this sort of dimensionless is the radius of the segment. So if it were exactly exponential with a constant, well, then it would be infinite. But because this is going to zero, at least if it does pinch off, it's conceivable that this is not inconsistent with the Horowitz-Mader theorem, that you could have a pinch off in a finite time without violating their theorem. Since then, there's also been a series of, I would say, sort of anecdotal evidence for the pinch off scenarios in that over the last few years, there have been these hydrodynamic Einstein equation relationships that people have been sort of exploring. That's actually started many, many years before in the so-called membrane paradigm, and even a little bit before some work that Thibaud and Moore did. And they essentially try to describe, and it's what you heard from Carlos, but sort of the electromagnetic properties of black holes, but you can also associate sort of fluid-like properties to the evolution of the horizon. And what you find is that if you sort of, in some approximate sense, horizons behave like fluids, and particularly very low viscosity fluids. So they satisfy some effective, or we could describe the dynamics of horizons by a Navier-Stokes equation with low viscosity. And that's sort of recently been extended to higher dimensions and various sort of flavors of this correspondence. And actually, what I think was perhaps most interesting is this work by Cardoso and Diaz. But this is not a formal sort of expansion of the field equations, but they also just noted that the dispersion relation in higher dimensions for a stream of a cylinder of fluid with surface tension that's subject to the Rayleigh-Tautou instability has at least qualitatively a very similar dispersion relation to the Gregory-Laplace one. So why is that evidence for Pinchot? Well, you know, fluids are rife with instabilities, and in particular, the Rayleigh-Plateau instability. This is the instability that develops in a thin stream of fluid. So if you like, you know, turn on your tap and try and get a very, very thin stream going, it doesn't stay a thin stream of water for long. That this is exactly this kind of long wavelength instability that develops, and here it does Pinchot. And the arguments sort of why this should develop, at least at leading order argument, is quite similar to the black hole case, except it's not entropy or area, but it's total energy. So above some critical wavelength, the surface tension to get it's energetically more favorable to have a sequence of little drops of water as opposed to a long stream. But of course, now these are all now at least the more formal analogies, which are based on the field equations, like the black folds, the membrane paradigm. Those are usually leading order relationships. And of course, this is just completely an analog. It just looks similar. So to really answer these questions, we really need to understand the nonlinear evolution of Einstein's equations. And so that's what me and Luis looked at again. I'm going to just very quickly go through the formalism. If people are more interested in this, they can ask me later. But essentially, so we want to solve the vacuum Einstein field equations in five dimensions. And we're going to use something called the harmonic coordinate condition. But to stabilize the code, we need constraint damping. And the only comment that I'll say here in this sort of for people, that this is just an interesting little side comment. So in the original constraint damping proposed by Carsten Grunlach and collaborators, there are these two parameters that you can control. So most people before have just set the second parameter to zero. Though we found that in this case, we're not going to be able to simulate an infinite string, so we have to compactify, but that allows a zero wavelength mode to be present. And it wasn't sufficient just to use this parameter. We had to set the second parameter to kill the instability. The other thing that was important, and this what we hadn't done in previous attempts, so we had tried harmonic coordinates before, but because, again, we can do full five-dimensional simulations, that's computationally much too expensive, we were just going to do sort of spherical symmetry in the four-dimensional slice plus the extra dimensions, so a 2+1-dimensional simulation. And so we used coordinates adapted to the symmetry and imposed that they were harmonic, and we could not get that to work. And there have been several studies since that says that that's a difficult problem. So in this time we say, well, forget it. Let's just do the full five-dimensional. We'll use five-dimensional Cartesian coordinates, but we'll impose the symmetries essentially using the killing vectors of those of the symmetry. In other words, we're going to look at five-dimensional Cartesian coordinates, but if we have this SO3 symmetry, we have these killing vectors, which means we can take a 2+1-dimensional slice of that and use these symmetries to compute derivatives that are orthogonal to the slice. So it's full Cartesian code. We evolve all the metrics. There's no at least a priori symmetry, but we just evolve a slice of this. Just one very quick slide. It's finite difference techniques. We're using adaptive mesh refinement. We're going to create initial data. We're perturbing it with gravitational waves. So we're going to give it a little bit of a kick to excite this instability. It's periodic in this extra dimension. So the nice thing about making it periodic is we don't have a full spectrum of unstable modes. And so what we can do is we can make it periodic with a length that only, at least initially, only the most unstable mode can be excited. And so this is the one at the, I'll show you the dispersion relation. That's the one that's essentially sitting at the top of the dispersion relation. We were naive with the boundary conditions, the outer boundary conditions. We just had Dirichlet conditions, but we made the domain sufficiently large that it was out of causal contact with the local string dynamics throughout the simulation. Okay, so let me show you the results. So what I'm going to show you here is an embedding diagram of the apparent horizon. So it's a 2+1-dimensional simulation. The apparent horizon, which at least from earlier studies, is a very good approximation to the event horizon.
Periodic boundary condition.
We do in the extra dimensions.
Yeah. It is.
Yes. Okay, so so this is the apparent horizon, and so the two coordinates here are, so one, a point here R represents the aerial radius of that particular point. And just for visual aid, I sort of spun it around the axis, but it's just, in the simulation, it's just a one-dimensional surface. And then the Z coordinate is defined that on this flat Euclidean geometry of the screen, the proper length along this horizon is exactly the same as that of the intrinsic geometry of the horizon. So what you'll see early on is the instability as we saw before. So we're sort of perturbing this, you see it grow, and now it forms this very thin neck. But now what you'll see is if you look closely, well, this is a thin neck, it looks like a black string, it should be unstable, and it is, and this process starts to repeat. So you get this sort of self-similar sort of cascade down to small scales where all throughout the process, at any little segment, it looks like you have a very thin string segment. And that string segment itself becomes unstable, and you sort of get this cascade down to smaller scales. Incidentally, so that was when Gary Horowitz saw some of the earlier simulations, his objection was that it couldn't be the end state. Well, that can't possibly be because it looks like a long thin string. It's got to be unstable.
And he's exactly right. It is unstable. Sorry?
Do you understand the asymmetry? So you've got a lot more bumps in the upper half here.
Right. I'll mention a little bit about that later. I'll mention in a few seconds. So, I mean, incidentally, we've only got one of these things in the periodic domains. You've identified that with that, but just for visual aid, I unwrapped it a bit. So now, in just this next animation, it's exactly the same simulation, but I mean, just to show you that things are proceeding sort of in a qualitatively in a self-similar manner to small scales. I'm going to zoom in. I mean, one thing to notice is also the clock is slowing down. So this thing isn't happening in uniform time. And so here it goes. Now this is unstable. And so now if we zoom in, we see, okay, there we get this sort of the next generation. But this neck is continually thinning down, but it's continually sort of unstable to these perturbations. And if we keep going, we just see it repeats. Continue, or at least as far as we were able to run the simulations. And incidentally, because these small-scale features are developing, so we're using adaptive mesh refinement. So in this one, which was one of the furthest one we pushed, it took about a month of supercomputer time. So 128 nodes running for a month. And even though it's only 2+1 dimensional, like compared to the people can do 3-dimensional binary black hole mergers in that time easily. But the problem here is that we only have a small length scale developing in one direction. In other words, along the string length, we have to fully refine the domain. So it's sort of a length filling or a volume filling feature in one direction. So it very quickly becomes very expensive. Okay, I mentioned the time is slowing down, and that's intuitive because this, at least locally, this is like a string. The time scale for this to develop is related to the radius of the string, and so these things are developing on shorter and shorter timescales. So just to give you some idea of that, here's just one of the metric components now, but which I'm going to show you now in the coordinate harmonic time. Just to give you some idea of, don't worry about what this means, and these are the periodic domains, which I haven't identified, but just to see what sort of how it unfolds in sort of real time. The first generation, the second, and then essentially everything happens. Okay, so I think in some sense the move, to me at least, the movie sort of says it all, I think. So what is the end state of this instability? I think very clearly it's going to a pinch-off, though in a way that's perhaps much more interesting than initially anticipated. It's doing it through a series of self-similar, self-similar cascade, where at every scale you locally get this kind of instability. But now we're just going to sort of try and extract a few properties from the simulation to see if that makes sense. And the first is just the area of the horizon at late times. And this is the calculation, if it were exactly a sequence of black holes versus a black string with this particular length. And so we have a little bit of extra energy here because we've added gravitational waves. But by the end of the simulation, it's actually very close to that. So it does seem this entropic argument of how it should evolve does seem to be bearing out. So also, I mean, if this, if you know, if if this is really what's happening, that locally this is just like a string, you know, despite these big lumps of spherical black hole. And if these really are like black holes, well, can we say more by looking at the geometry of the solution? So we looked at a couple of things. We evaluated two curvature invariants on the horizon, so Riemann squared and Riemann cubed, and normalized them in such a way so that along the black hole, these two invariants both evaluate to 6, and along the black string, they both evaluate to 1. And here's a snapshot of the horizon at late times with those two curvature invariants evaluated. So this, you can see there, is just for reference, the shape of the horizon. And you can see that, at least qualitatively, it really looks like, so in the regions where it's string-like, both those invariants are quite close to 1. In the regions where it is spherical-like, at least one invariant is close to 6, and the other one is sort of tending towards 6 at the centers of the spheres. So that seems to suggest this is a decent description of what's going on. And so this is a lot of information, I guess, for the sake of time. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but this is sort of getting back to your question now. So if we want to somehow now interpret this as sort of generations of Gregory Laplace style instabilities, this is just a table sort of trying to extract from the simulation what's going on. This is the time for the first generation, how many satellites we see form, second generation, the third one, fourth one. And so in some of the things are getting very uncertain just because the simulations are becoming so, at least sort of these uncertainties are because the simulations are becoming so complex we can't run computation intensive, we can't run that many resolutions to really nail it. But why we might expect that things aren't quite as symmetric is that, you see, so in this first generation, we set the ratio of length to radius to be exactly 10 for the string. And so we only had this one mode that was being excited. But what happens after this mode is excited, and on subsequent generations, the ratio of length to radius is of on the order of 100, and this critical ratio would be 7.2. So we just allowed that one most unstable mode to be excited. But if we go back to this diagram, let me just use this one. Essentially, what's happening is, because of the periodicity, we only allowed that mode to be excited. But now we've got a much longer string segment, and several of these modes can now be excited in the subsequent thing. And in particular, there are two modes that have very, very similar growth rates. But depending on which one is excited, one is, you know, is going to have several bumps, whereas one might only have one. And so depending on which one of those modes develops slightly first, you're going to form 1, 2, 3 little satellites in that segment. And by that time, you know, just small perturbations, whether it's mostly numerical error that's at that time perturbing it, that sort of breaks the symmetry. So we think that there's sort of a good physical reason why it's so sensitive. Exactly the sequence that happens is probably mostly just because of numerical error.
It looks from the movie that the radius is shrinking a lot more than the distance between neighboring black holes from generation to generation. Is that?
Not really. These things are quite uncertain, but it seems to be roughly, in each one of these generations, it's about the same. It's not that we get situations where there's some that are 10 and some that are 1,000. Essentially, every little string segment that there is long enough to be unstable, and it's roughly roughly of that order. Oh. Yeah. So we get right here.
Asymmetry too, or So in the initial data, we are perturbing it in a way. But the stable mode should be dying out. But I mean, there could be some remnant. And actually, there will be gravitational waves that are being produced by this, at least very small amounts. We haven't looked at that yet. But If you look closely, for instance, you see, I think it's going to be on the second generation, there's a little, let me see if I can point it out, I think it's going to be over there. Oh, right there. See, there's something starting to form, but it actually gets swallowed up by that one. Mm-hmm. So it's starting to form. It's a locally almost having like these two bubbles and colliding. And so there must be a little bit of an emission of gravitational wave. And so this looks like sort of a clean picture, but they are, the dynamics is creating little perturbations, and presumably there's
some artifact of the initial conditions left over, but it's not. I mean, I haven't thought about this too carefully, but I'd be very surprised if you could even, in principle, come up with perfect initial data that preserved the symmetries exactly.
Little bubbles that form, are they stationary, or do they sit there, or are they actually moving?
So they're actually moving, and the reason why they look stationary is because the time is slowing down. Mm-hmm. So what the picture would be. Is that suppose, and I'll show you in the next couple of slides, is how we estimated that the segments that remain string-like forever are going to pinch off in finite time.
So, and we estimated about t equals 231, that's where it's going to happen. And so you'll have sort of an infinite set of ever smaller and smaller black holes, but they do have little velocities. Like you saw the one that was actually moving, but they do have slight velocities. And let's say quantum gravity is kind at the pinch off when it doesn't do anything special, then we're going to have these black holes with little velocities and they will eventually all merge. And so in particular, in this compactified case, the end state really will be just the sequence of big spherical black holes. Okay, so let me see, is that everything that I wanted to say there? Yeah, so now let's assume that things are happening. I think I'll be finished on time. So let's assume things are happening in a self-similar fashion. And to try to then estimate what the pinch-off time is, let's sort of estimate that the total time for pinch-off is given by some initial time that's a function of the initial data. So how hard we perturbed this, by how much we excited this initial mode. But if this is sort of roughly giving us some indication that after that first initial excitation, the little segments that form between any of the subsequent satellites is roughly the same, then it's perhaps not too unreasonable to suggest that the time scale for the next instability will be some constant fraction of that of the preceding generation. And of course, also, if the local radius is decreasing, that also makes sense if the time scale is related to the size of the string segment. And so this is what we get. This is a geometric series. We can sum it. And so taking roughly, guessing what we get from the data, we get this as the time to pinch off. Now, if that is correct, and we plot the thinning regions in logarithmic coordinates, so log of radius versus log of t minus the time of pinch off, the string-like segment should follow roughly a linear slope. So what I'm showing here are like four select points measured on the apparent horizon, so the log of the radius versus time. So this is the point that on the initial sphere that forms. These are points on sort of string segments that are collapsing. This is a second bubble that forms a collapsing. This is a third bubble, etc. This green one is one that's always remained string-like. So if you're like, what roughly is that slope? So this is a slope, a line with the slope negative one on this curve. So it's rough, it's not exactly linear. You wouldn't expect it to be, but it's roughly linear with a slope of negative one. But the interesting thing is, so back in quite a while ago, Eggers found for the Navier-Stokes analog. So he looked at just the pinching off region of a low viscosity fluid, and he found a scaling solution. And Miyamoto recently sort of repeated this work and updated it to higher dimensions. And in this case, they found that this is the way that the solution scaled for the Navier-Stokes, and it's also got a slope of negative one, which I think it's pretty interesting. I think if you get something which is self-similar, you're probably going to get some relationships like this. But I think it's quite interesting that this is looking like Rayleigh-Plateau. And the pinching off is actually sort of behaving in a sort of a quantitative sense like what Rayleigh-Plateau did. So to conclude then, I think as I mentioned before, so because this is a self-similar type solution, we don't have the resolution to follow it all the way to the end. We can just really extrapolate the trends we see in the simulation. But at least I think it's pretty convincing evidence that this thing is going to pinch off in finite time, but in the self-similar fashion. One interesting thing that sort of doing this relationship to fluids, so this is a set of images from actual experiments with fluids. And the interesting thing is very high viscosity fluids, they also pinch off, but they don't develop satellites. So for instance, if you did a stream of honey, it's going to form beads, but they will pinch off without forming satellites. And as you lower the viscosity in a real fluid, you get more and more generations of satellites that form up until some finite point, and then they all pinch off. And as far as I know, for Navier-Stokes solutions, it's not known that as you continue decreasing the viscosity, if there's a limit, if there's some viscosity below which there'll never be a finite generation, it will just continue forever. But then an interesting analog with the GR case is if you look at the membrane paradigm, black holes have lower viscosity than any real-world fluid. So they're, in some sense, they're probing that limiting case. And I suspect with the black hole case that it will carry on forever because there is no other scale in the problem. I don't see how that would... You need to put some other scale in the problem for that to happen. So some of the conclusions, some things that I've said before, just sort of one comment about this being a generic violation of cosmic censorship. That's something that sort of Luis pointed out to me. He slipped me a little note just before my talk. This is just an interesting observation. So perhaps, in the spirit of Penrose's original cosmic censorship, it's not necessarily that he didn't want to see effects of quantum gravity, but his worry was, okay, if these things are common, we wouldn't be able to predict the how the universe behaves. There are black holes in the universe. If they're naked singularities, we need a theory of quantum gravity, and we wouldn't be able to explain the universe. And so in some sense, cosmic censorship prevented us from having to explain or having to have a quantum theory of gravity to explain many events. But the interesting thing here with this, so this seems to be a generic violation of cosmic censorship, but if you just take the fluid example, we don't need molecular physics to understand fluid pinch-off. There are all these exact scaling solutions to the Navier-Stokes and the unique extensions through the pinch-off. And so that might be saying that perhaps in the spirit of the original cosmic censorship, this really isn't a problem. Okay, you might need quantum gravity for that exact pinch-off, but it might just be such a mild event that the classical picture is really giving us everything that's going on. I'll just end by saying that there are a lot of obvious future extensions in many other kinds of black objects which are unstable and will be useful to investigate their instabilities. But just notice that we've so far in this hydrodynamic black hole analog game, people have used fluids to try to gain a lot of insight into black holes. For example, what I showed you, at least trying to get insight into black holes. But we have this vast literature of work on fluids, and perhaps we can sort of take the reverse and try to use fluids to understand black holes in a more quantitative way. Thank you. So I
forgot to mention, we were also normal not just by constants, but by powers of the radius. Yeah. So, for example, on the black string, the little bit that's pinching off is typically going like 1 over r of the radius to the 4th power.
So that does sound kind of a bit severe, doesn't it? Another question. What you've drawn there, did you freeze or look at? So it looks like, right, these droplets connected by strings, but is that string bit really like the black string, or is it something else?
I probably, this is, as only bit that we can say how much it is like with X string is just by the fact that those two invariants are similar.
The next, I've got a student that's sort of working on a project to look at geodesics in the space-time. And so one thing we want to perhaps do is just, because I guess I think that these coordinates, these harmonic coordinates, are really well, they really are close to asymptotic coordinates. So we're saying that things pinch off in finite asymptotic time, but you can always argue about that. But one way to address that is to start with geodesics, a small distance outside, and trace them, radial geodesics. And I think if we do that, we'll be able to see, well, is this behaving exactly like a geodesic in a black string, an exact black string space-time? So I think that's one extra little bit of information that we might be able to say that, okay, even from a geodesic point of view, at least in the local vicinity of this black string, it's looking like a black string as well. So hopefully that will be in the next few months. No, so to prep this.
Does you slow the time down?
Yeah, so this is something logarithmic time coordinate.
Right.
So look at this sort of green thing. So here it sort of starts static. There's a period where it starts to go quite rapidly. It starts to slow down. Actually, this is where the previous simulation crashed.
So that was also why, I mean, if it had crashed in this state, we might have been much more bold and said, oh yeah, this is going straight to a pinch off. But because it was slowing down from earlier, it could be turning around and going back up. But so then it does slow down for a bit, but then sort of the next instability kicks in and keeps going. So there are periods where it looks like it's slowing down, but in general, the trend is very much that it's... Yeah, and then... So I think... With a scaling solution, I think you pick a point, a very symmetric point. So you also look at perturbations. So they allow for perturbations in the extra dimensions. So there's an overall curvature, and they look at the point that's most symmetric, and they get, in that point, a scaling solution. So we haven't exhaustively looked at all points on the horizon, but I suspect that there will be a few special points where you do see this exact scaling. And I'm guessing asymptotically, that as you approach,
do that.
No, I'm guessing.
Okay.
We haven't. So we've only looked at it. So I picked, like, for this point, I picked something that was just in between two little black.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't do any.
But there is such a. So you're, when this is about to pinch off, you see a linear time dependence. But from Greg Wolf's work with Ray, you have the exponential. So there is actually two dynamical processes going on. One where their instability kicks in. And then another one, you basically have to deplete, in some sense, the thin strings to get them below or above the critical regime so that the next one takes over. And this is kind of representative of this behavior. But as he's just saying, we did notice that there are points that essentially are shrinking all the time. But the rate, and that's maybe I'm not saying he believes that, but the rate, I think, is going to go like that. So I'm not sure there's one point where you can see this, also this exponential decay.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
So could you draw the minimum radius?
It's not exponential, is it?
Linear. Right. Linear. I know there. You know there are places where it's exponentially, and others where it's linear. So you're going to have to have this.
Correct. So I guess the minimum, the minimum radius that's been reached in this simulation already.
No, I mean this is for some individual Z's that you're drawing.
Yes,
but you can, at any time you can find a minimum radius of the horizon and then draw that, and that's going to be the lower.
It's going to be very close to this point. So there's in each of the string segments there's a little bit of curvature, but they very much between any two bubbles. It's very much within a fraction of a percent. It's about a constant.
So it's getting late at dinner time. postpone further discussions until dinner. Let's thank all the speakers again. And let's in particular thank the organizers of this conference, Adrienne and Latham.
And so we actually
actually have a reservation for 5 minutes from now at the Lions Pub in Uptown Waterloo. So if anyone.